From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Brother Fraction was a member of my church, and, mm-hmm. and we worked together with young men in a manhood training program that the church had. And he passed away very abruptly and suddenly. My wife and I went to spend some time with his family, you know, upon his passing, and we just listened to all the stories that, you know, the elders from the church were telling, and people, you know, there was one man who talked about how he didn't know what a whole piece of chalk looked like until he got to college, because growing up he went to the segregated schools and they only got, you know, broken pieces and nubs, right, of chalk that were passed down from the white schools. And you know, I knew about segregated schools, but just like hearing that story, I realized I didn't really understand the indignity and the stupidity and the just really dastardly nature of it. And it made me feel like, you know, as we were driving home that night, you know, I asked my wife, why don't we have a museum to tell these stories?
The Honorable Robert L. Wilkins, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and author of Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture, published by Proud Legacy Publishing. In his book, Wilkins chronicled the early history in creating a monument for African American soldiers, beginning 50 years after the end of the Civil War and later evolving to creating a national museum. Wilkins followed the endless obstacles through the decades, including political plots and deliberate maneuvering to block the construction of the museum, and the world events that put it at the bottom of priorities. Also, the book is a memoir with Wilkins actively participating role in reviving the idea of the museum, recounting the years of political roadblocks and also the honor of becoming a member of the presidential commission that wrote the plan for creating it. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Long Road to Hard Truth with the Honorable Robert L. Wilkins, In Black America.
So the National Memorial Association was that nonprofit that was started by a black lawyer in D.C. named Ferdinand Lee, educated at Hampton University and Howard Law School. And so that National Memorial Association pushed for legislation to be passed to build this building, this memorial building or this museum. And they had a black architect named E.R. Williams create a scale model and design for the proposed building. And they finally were able in 1929 to get Congress to authorize the creation of an entity called the National Memorial Commission that would raise the money and do all of the planning for this African American museum. They called it, again, the National Memorial Building to Negro Achievement.
In Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture, Judge Wilkins tells the story of how his curiosity about why there wasn't a national museum dedicated to African American history and culture became an obsession, eventually leading him to quit his job as an attorney when his wife was 7 months pregnant with their second child, and make it his mission to help the museum become a reality. Long Road to Hard Truth chronicles the early history when staunch advocates sought to create a monument for African-American soldiers 50 years after the end of the Civil War, and in response to pervasive indignities of the time, including lynchings, Jim Crow segregation, and the slander of the racist film Birth of a Nation. In September 2016, exactly 100 years after the movement to create it began, the Smithsonian opened the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. Recently, In Black America spoke with the Honorable Robert L. Wilkins.
I was born in Muncie, Indiana, also known as Middletown, USA, because it was deemed kind of like the typical Midwestern small town, and there's been lots of sociology studies that have been done on it over the years. Went to college in Indiana at Rose-Hulman Institute of Technology and studied chemical engineering. Decided that engineering wasn't for me and decided to go into law school, went to Harvard Law School. And I worked for an African-American federal judge in San Diego. And then I came to Washington, D.C. in 1990 and have stayed here ever since, working first as a public defender And then for a nonprofit that I started to push to create a national museum dedicated to African American history and culture, and then for 9 years as a partner at a law firm before coming on to the bench 5 years ago as a federal judge, first at the trial court level and then on the Federal Court of Appeals.
What was life like growing up in Muncie during the civil rights movement when it was really hitting its stride?
So, you know, Muncie, I guess, was one of these towns where there were a lot of people who worked in the auto industry, mm-hmm. and a lot of the blacks had come up from the South, from Memphis and various other areas in the South to work in the plants. My grandfather worked at a Delco battery plant for 30-plus years. And, you know, the black folks kind of lived in their part of town. There were kind of two black neighborhoods mm-hmm. Growing up, and you had to be careful if you ventured outside of those neighborhoods, you know, as I was a child. There was even an incident where, you know, somebody burned a house to the ground where some black folks moved into kind of a lower class white neighborhood, you know, when I was in high school. You know, that was like around 1980, so that was still a sentiment then. You know, so we were aware of those issues, but I guess as a child, you know, you just learned how to manage them and you know, defend yourself and try to avoid conflict where necessary.
How did you go from studying chemical engineering to studying law? What sparked that interest in the law?
I think around that time, you know, I graduated from college in 1986. So around 84, 85, while I was in college, you know, I just started becoming more interested in national affairs and civil rights issues and just seeing what was going on in the world around me. And I thought that rather than, you know, solving problems, you know, involving machines or processes and businesses, I wanted to be more involved in kind of human issues. And so I thought that the law would be a better fit for me. And that's what sparked me going to law school. I really wanted to get involved in either, you know, some sort of public service or civil rights work of some sort.
Tell us about your work as a public defender in the District of Columbia. What were some of the things that really made an impression on you as a young adult?
It was a wonderful job, and it was a wonderful experience, but it was also a very heart-wrenching and eye-opening experience mm-hmm. because, you know, by definition, all of your clients are poor.
Right.
By mm-hmm. definition, they're all in dire straits. You know, they're facing imprisonment. They've come from oftentimes neglectful household where there's drug abuse or alcohol abuse or mental illness or other societal issues that have, you know, that are affecting the household. They're either affecting my clients or they're affecting their mother or father or a sibling. And so it was just, you know, while I really enjoyed it on one level and enjoyed doing my part to make sure that people got effective representation and weren't railroaded and were treated fairly and equally, hopefully, by the system. It was also, you know, a depressing job in some ways just because, you know, there were so many young African-American men who I would represent who oftentimes could barely read even though they were 16, 17, 18 years old mm-hmm. and supposedly in 9th or 10th grade. And you know, you just see these kinds of things over and over and over again. And you'd see the cycle repeating, you know, somebody and you'd hear that their father was in prison and then now they're about to go to prison and all of that. I even had one client whose family was the subject of a Pulitzer Prize winning series by the Washington Post in 1995, I think it was. And, you know, because they followed his grandmother, who was a heroin addict and a prostitute, and his mother, who was a heroin addict and a prostitute. And then he basically, you know, had to raise himself on the streets and was involved with, you know, drug dealing and other stuff. And you know, and came to need my representation because of charges that he had picked up. And so, you know, I was seeing the effects of the crack epidemic, and D.C. was called the murder capital of the world during that time when I was there, and so a lot of that was what really motivated me to want to get involved in something that would be positive, edifying, and hopefully educational for people to see, you know, how far we've come, but also to see the opportunities that they have so that they wouldn't squander them. And that's what made me think that, working and dedicating a lot of my life to creating this museum was a worthwhile venture.
We hear phrases, but we never really know where they come from or how the phrase came to be. An incident happened with you in the spring of 92. Tell us about it.
Well, I was returning along with my uncle and his son, my first cousin, and my uncle's wife, so the four of us. We had driven to Chicago for my grandfather's funeral, and then we were driving back home a few days later, and we had driven all night so that we could be back in time for the, you know, be at work. We all worked. I had to be in court that morning, and so about 5 in the morning, we get stopped a couple hours outside of D.C. in Cumberland, Maryland, by a state trooper, and instead of writing my cousin a ticket for speeding, going 60 and a 40, he said, you know, I want to search the car for drugs. And we told him that, you know, we didn't want to give him permission to do that. And we just wanted him to write the ticket so that we could be on our way. And he said, well, if you got nothing to hide, what's your problem? And I explained to him I was a lawyer. In fact, I was a public defender, and that, you know, the Constitution says that we have rights and the right not to be subject to unreasonable searches and seizures, and we just want to exercise our rights like everybody else. And he said, you know, well, nobody ever objects, and we have a problem with rental cars and drugs. And, you know, we explained to him that, you know, just because you're driving a rental car doesn't mean you got drugs, and just please let us go. But he wouldn't, and he made us wait there for a drug sniffing dog to be brought to the scene, even though I told him the name of the U.S. Supreme Court case that said he shouldn't be doing that. And we had to stand outside in a line by the side of the road in the rain while this German Shepherd went around our rented Cadillac, which ironically my uncle had rented so that we'd be comfortable on this long drive. And subject to the stares and glares of all the people driving up and down the highway,
right,
while we're lined up there. And the dog doesn't find anything, and we're on our way. We later, after we sued them, learned that they had a written policy targeting African Americans and rental cars for drug searches. And so we were able to prove that they had a policy and practice of targeting blacks. We got a smoking gun, the written racial drug courier profile. And so we used that leverage to extract a favorable settlement from them. And that was, so I was part of the efforts to kind of make Driving While Black a household name back then.
No, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with the Honorable Robert L. Wilkins, D.C. Circuit Court Judge, and author of Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-Year Mission to Create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Judge Wilkins, what led you to begin this long journey to write this book?
So, you know, I really wanted the story to be told. And so I had it in my mind, you know, over 10 years ago that I would write this book. But of course, having it in your mind and doing it are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't get serious about writing it until about a year and a half ago. And but I wanted, when the museum opened, I wanted this book to be out so that people would know the true story of how it came to be, and that it was a 100-year journey, so that people would appreciate the institution and hopefully support it and, you know, understand the context of the historical context of the struggle to open it. So, you know, it was a long time in the making in that sense.
But you talk about in the book about Lewis Fraction and a comment he made that actually led to an impetus for you to pursue this dream of yours.
So, yes, Lewis Fraction, Brother Fraction, was a member of my church, and, mm-hmm. and we worked together with young men in a manhood training program that the church had. And he passed away very abruptly and suddenly, and my wife and I went to spend some time with his family, upon his passing, and we just listened to all the stories that, you know, the elders from the church were telling, and people, you know, there was one man who talked about how he didn't know what a whole piece of chalk looked like until he got to college, because, you know, growing up he went to the segregated schools and they only got, you know, pieces, broken pieces and nubs right. of chalk that were passed down from the white schools. And, you know, I knew about segregated schools, but just like hearing that story, I realized I didn't really understand the indignity and the stupidity and the just really dastardly nature of it. And it made me feel like, you know, as we were driving home that night, you know, I asked my wife, why don't we have a museum to tell these stories? And that really set it off for me.
Yeah, I understand. I was asking you, you know, I began reading, you know, reading the book, and I'm thinking to myself, why am I reading this information about the Union Civil War parade? And as I read more, it actually got into some of the snubbing that African-American soldiers received. Tell us about that story and how that actually led to the beginning of you telling your story about this museum that you wanted to take place.
So the reason that I started there at the end of the Civil War is because in some ways those events motivated the beginning efforts of the movement to create this museum about mm-hmm. 50 years later.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't know anything about this huge victory parade that was called the Grand Review of the Armies for Union soldiers at the end of the Civil War. I didn't learn about that in my history classes. And but it was this fabulous thing, you know, 200,000 soldiers paraded from the Capitol down Pennsylvania Avenue past the White House over the course of 2 days. It took, you know, 7 hours each day, and there were, you know, tens of thousands of people lined up along the streets, and it was front page news and every newspaper across the country, and everybody raved about it. But there were no black combat soldiers in this parade.
Mm-hmm.
They were completely excluded. And you know, so the blacks had their own victory parade in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a few months later, but
right.
of course it was not nearly the same. And so when this parade was reenacted for the 50th anniversary of the Union victory, blacks were allowed to participate, but everything was segregated in 1915.
Right.
And they didn't even let any blacks be on the committee of arrangements that were, you know, planning all of the events, and basically said to the blacks that if you want to have any balls or events or banquets and things for the black veterans, you have to do it yourself. And so a colored citizens committee was formed and to do all of those arrangements. And so the black soldiers, veterans came, but it was kind of really bittersweet, because they were at least allowed to participate in the march, but as second-class citizens. And they were also doing so as the movie Birth of a Nation was making its way across the country.
Right.
Slandering them, their efforts, and the African American, you know, people. And so, you know, in the face of all of that, this group that had come together, this Colored Citizens Committee, said, we're going to form a nonprofit, and we are going to use that organization to build a permanent physical memorial to black soldiers and sailors and everything that they've done to support and defend the Constitution and the United States in every war from the Revolutionary War on up to the then present. But within a couple of years, especially as blacks served in World War I successfully and bravely and honorably and came back, they said, you know, this should be more than a soldier's memorial. This should be a national memorial building that has exhibits and tablets and statues and information about Negro achievement and contributions to America in all facets of endeavor, essentially a national African-American museum. And so that is what inspired it, and that's when, as best as I can tell, this movement began.
Tell us about how do we get from the commission to the National Memorial Association.
So the National Memorial Association was that nonprofit that was started by a black lawyer in D.C. named Ferdinand Lee,
right,
educated at Hampton University and Howard Law School. And so that National Memorial Association pushed for legislation to be passed to build this building, this memorial building or this museum. And they had a black architect named E.R. Williams create a scale model and design for the proposed building. And they finally were able in 1929 to get Congress to authorize the creation of an entity called the National Memorial Commission that would raise the money and do all of the planning for this African-American museum. They called it, again, the National Memorial Building to Negro Achievement. The problem was the only way that this bill could get passed in the face of the Southern opposition, who believed that there was no such thing as Negro achievement or contributions, and so they mocked the whole thing and instead, you know, supported a monument to the faithful colored mammies of the South and that kind of foolishness. But the only way that they could get a bill passed was to strip it of all funding. And because originally they tried to get $50,000 in seed funding from Congress,
right,
so that they could raise another $500,000 to construct the museum. And the bill got amended so that this National Memorial Commission would have to raise $500,000, and then Congress would kick in $50,000. And that was mocked by some as basically a useless gesture by Congress, but the people wanting to build this, if that was the only thing that they could get passed, they said, fine, we'll find a way to do this. So the bill is passed. It's signed by President Calvin Coolidge on his last day in office in March of 1929. The timing is terrible, though, because the stock market crashes
exactly
a few months later in October, and it's the beginning of the Depression. And so it basically doomed this project from the beginning.
You talk about moving into an office building, and we're going to get back to some of the information in the making of the memorial. But you talk about moving into an office building, which used to be an old department store in Washington. It's named after, excuse me, Mary Church Terrell. And how did that have an effect on you, knowing that you're moving into a building that has been one of your sheroes during your lifetime?
It was really, really a chilling experience because here I was in 2002 moving into a building named after Mary Church Terrell, and I'm serving on a commission, a presidential commission that Congress had created to plan for this National Museum of African American History and Culture. And so I'm doing that in a building named after Mary Church Terrell when she was on that 1929 commission that Congress created to do the exact same thing. So I was literally standing on her shoulders trying to complete the work that she and others had worked on, you know, generations before, in a building named after her, and in a building that it was named after her because she had pushed to desegregate the building when it was a major department store in Washington, D.C., and everything was segregated, and the lunch counters and cafeteria and everything was segregated. So it just seemed almost like God was speaking to me that, you know, I needed to finish her work and was putting me in the right place to do so.
When you look back at the efforts and some of the stumbling blocks, what comes to mind, the tenacity that the individuals had to make this a reality?
You know, I go back to the 1915, 1916 time period, because to me, you know, the audacity, and I use that in a positive, constructive way, of these people is really amazing, because you had Birth of a Nation coming out and taking the country by storm. You had bills being introduced to ban blacks from serving in the military by some racist and segregationist congressmen, saying that you know, blacks weren't fit to serve in the military, and they were, you know, destroying the morale of the military because whites didn't want to serve with them, and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, you know, black people being lynched and having to deal with all of the inhumanity of you know, the black codes and Jim Crow segregation, et cetera. But yet these people had the foresight, the wisdom, the courage, and the audacity to say, we want a national memorial and a national museum dedicated to Negro achievement. And part of their thinking was this will affirm us as human beings, as people who are equal in the eyes of God, and display our contributions, our achievements, and maybe if we can do that, it will also lend support to the fight against lynching and all of these other evils that they had to deal with in society. And so in that sense, I think it was a very farsighted move by them.
What type of effect did the Kerner Commission have on this effort back in 1968?
Well, that's an interesting question. And another fact that I didn't know until I was researching this book, which was that, you know, after the riots across the country that caused the Kerner Commission to be formed, mm-hmm. you know, there was an effort in Congress and within the black community perhaps to have this museum or some sort of a commission to promote the study of African American history as a way to, you know, help bring the races together, to bring some understanding, to have young people feel like the country cares about them.
The Honorable Robert L. Wilkins, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.